You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to an audience question about an historical football team.
Gene Jansen wrote to Wisconsin about the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, a semi-pro football team that played for three decades, a mere 25 miles from Lambeau Field. He remembered the team from his youth and hoped to learn more about its history. With his help, WPR's Jenny Peek hit the archives to learn more.
When Gene Jansen was a boy, he spent many Sunday mornings helping ready the field for the Little Chute Flying Dutchman, his town's very own semi-pro football team.
We'd go to the lumber yard, and that's where we'd get the line and at this machine and put the lines up. And all the yard markers had to be 17 and a half inches in from the sidelines, you know. And it took a long time because you had 50 yards one way and 50 yards going the other way.
That was in the late 1940s, but the team got its start in 1920. Over the years, the Flying Dutchman played teams across central and northeast Wisconsin. And while the Dutchmen were able to suit up as a team for 30 straight years, other teams came and went.
After the war, there was other teams that had not have a team because of the war, took a lot of their players away. Fortunately, in Little Chute, we were able to keep going because the St. John's High School was giving teams that the players could keep playing. And so a lot of those players went on to play for the Flying Dutchman.
So what were some of the teams the Flying Dutchman played?
The main four teams was Manitowoc Gales, the Two Rivers Ramblers, and Little Chute, and the Merrill Foxes. I think it was, believe it, 1938. Later on was the New London Edisons, the Clintonville Four-Wheeler Drive Truckers, and the Appleton Reds.
But the Dutchmen didn't just play semi-pro teams. Legend has it they also played the Green Bay Packers.
I was able to trace it to 1920. By talking to some of the guys, I heard it was 52-0 that Little Chute got whomped. However, when you read more, it shows where one of the teams actually beat the Packers. I think it was the 1935, you know, like an exhibition game or something like that. The only one of a semi-pro team that ever beat the Packers.
Jansen says fans of the Little Chute Flying Dutchman even tailgated like the Cheeseheads of today.
When they played ball at halftime, where did some of the crowd go at halftime? Where the heck are those guys going? Well, here they're going across the road about a block away, and this guy had a garage, and he had beer in that garage with coolers. And those guys would go over there and get a can of beer, you know. And he had his whole garage lined up with all different kinds of beer cans, different brands. I think that's how he got his collection.
The team disbanded in 1950. Jim Bunger is now 91, played toward the end of the Flying Dutchman's reign.
And I played with Dutchman 47, 48, 49. I played tackle and guard most of the time, both ways, on defense and offense.
But like many of his teammates, Bunger's had to eventually say goodbye to football.
In 50, I got married. Well, then football was over with for me. Yeah, I couldn't take a chance on getting hurt more or anything after I got married. Oh, I really enjoyed playing football net, but it's just after you get married that you don't play that anymore.
Now 81, Jansen hopes to pass along some of the history he remembers so fondly.
Like I said, it was crowds like sometimes 3,000 people at that game because, you know, years ago there was no television, you know, and that's how it was. Everybody went to a game. People followed everything. And now it's hard to get people to get involved, even volunteering. You know, it's keep things going that you used to belong to. I love helping people, and I just, this is history that people should know.
You gotta be a football hero to get along with the beautiful girls.
This story came from an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now we look at what President Biden may do with Trump-era policies on abortion, contraception, and reproductive health. Dr. Anthony Fauci, Biden's chief medical advisor, announced in a speech to the World Health Organization yesterday that Biden will repeal anti-abortion restrictions on American aid in the coming days, known as the Mexico City Rule. What policy reversals are you watching for? What about the prospects for the Hyde Amendment? It's 800-642-1234. Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law. She is the author of Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Mary, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, here we are talking about Roe on the 48th anniversary. You've looked so closely at what we mean when we talk about the Roe decision and in some ways how the original Roe decision is long gone. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think there are two things. One is that we just use Roe to mean very different things. So, for example, President Biden on the campaign trail vowed to codify Roe or make Roe the law of the land, as he put it. And that really sparked a debate about what he meant. So Mike Pence, for example, said that meant he wanted abortion until birth, and pro-choice leaders pushed back and said, of course, that's not what Roe v. Wade means. So to begin with, we use Roe to symbolize lots of different things. But even on the legal plane, the Supreme Court has already dialed back legal protections without officially overturning Roe. So now it's a lot easier for states to pass abortion restrictions that will be upheld than it would have been in 1973.
These are the thousands of cuts that you often write about, talk about. And, you know, you've studied how anti-abortion leaders try to get around the idea of respect for court precedent and this patchwork of laws governing abortion around the country. Do you see that changing at all over the next 4 years?
It's hard to say, right? I mean, there's been some sign with a 6-3 conservative Supreme Court majority that we might move beyond the death of thousand cuts approach into something more aggressive or absolute, right? So something that looks much closer to a direct overturning of Roe in the next few years. I think that's a little bit less likely, in part because of President Biden and this election and the fact that the Democrats control the Senate, because there are at least potential consequences to a really aggressive court action like that. We've seen discussion of, for example, the Democrats changing the size or composition of the Supreme Court. I don't see that happening necessarily, but if the court were, for example, to overrule Roe in June, I think that would become a lot more likely. That kind of decision would be very controversial. So I think the fact that the Senate is in Democratic hands makes a death of a thousand cuts approach more likely.
You know, earlier on in the pandemic, we saw some states try to limit abortions by labeling them as an elective surgery. Is this still happening? What is the state of abortions right now during the pandemic?
Well, we haven't seen as much of that, in part because the states that were moving to treat abortions as unessential medical procedures were also the states that were essentially opposed to lockdown orders and mask ordinances. And so since most of those mostly red states are now completely open, and it's harder, obviously, to justify banning abortions as unessential medical procedures when you're allowing every medical procedure, essential or not, to go forward. What we've seen instead recently is that the Supreme Court has reinstated requirement for abortion medication. Now, what that means in practical terms is that for women who are seeking, or pregnant people generally seeking, early abortions, they can often in the first 10 weeks use abortion pills to have those procedures, and a lot of patients prefer that. And now again, the FDA once again is requiring that you actually go in person to pick up a pill, even though you can take the pill at home. That had been blocked for a while because of the pandemic. The Supreme Court just reinstated the requirement, so that'll make it harder for people to have early trimester abortions without face-to-face contact.
Yeah, and so that's the FDA versus American College of OBGYNs. That decision was handed down this month. Is that indicative at all, a sign at all, about where the high court is headed on this issue?
It definitely could be. I think the reason for that in part is because this decision didn't really need to happen. So the court had sort of sat on this case for 6 months, what looked like kind of waiting for it to go away. And now it would have gone away, right? The Biden administration will likely change the FDA a Biden administration FDA will likely eliminate this in-person requirement. So if the court just didn't want to get into this at all, they probably could have waited and the case would have vanished. So the fact that the court reached out and decided this anyway looks like a court that's interested in taking on the abortion issue and rolling back abortion rights.
We're discussing reproductive policy and what the new Biden administration will do in the first 100 days. Abortion is arguably the most divisive issue in U.S. politics. What are you watching for out of the Biden administration? What do you think about Biden planning to repeal the Mexico City rule that bans foreign non-governmental organizations from performing or promoting abortions as a condition of receiving U.S. aid? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mary Ziegler here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Florida State Law Professor Mary Ziegler. Her legal scholarship is at the intersection of reproduction, the family, sexuality, and the Constitution. President Biden was sworn in as a U.S. senator in 1973, the very year Roe v. Wade made abortion a constitutional right, 48 years ago today. We're examining what reproductive policy could look like in the Biden administration and where Roe stands today. With your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Mary, let's look at the Mexico City rule for a moment. President Biden plans to reverse this policy. First, explain for us what this rule is.
So this rule deals with abortion counseling and services abroad. So it's often referred to, it's actually unfortunately one of several things referred to as a gag rule. Essentially, it blocks U.S. federal funding for any organization that provides abortion counseling or referrals or performs abortion services or even advocates to decriminalize abortion. So in practical terms, you would imagine that organizations like Planned Parenthood abroad are prohibited from receiving U.S. foreign aid to do any of those things, but also from receiving aid at all, given that they essentially advocate for abortion rights. So there's been a kind of ping pong effect with the Mexico City policy going back to Ronald Reagan, where you see anti-abortion GOP administrations imposing the Mexico City policy and Democratic pro-choice administrations reversing that step. So this isn't anything new. I think what we're more curious to see with the Biden administration is if we see kind of new steps on abortion, for example, like the elimination of the Hyde Amendment. That would be much more striking.
Yeah, I thought that's exactly where I thought you might be headed with the Hyde Amendment, barring federal funding for most abortions, which Biden has flipped back and forth with here. Can you explain the Hyde Amendment, where it stands, and what the Biden administration may do?
Sure. The Hyde Amendment is a ban on Medicaid reimbursement for abortion. So in practical terms, that means that patients who are relying on Medicaid can't get Medicaid to cover their abortions. There are other ways that low-income women can try to get their abortions paid for, often through private kinds of nonprofits, but there is no federal governmental medical program that does that. And it's been part of appropriations bills, basically, usually for the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. So every time there's an appropriation for that department, the Hyde Amendment's been attached to it. There's been a kind of bipartisan consensus going back some time in support of the Hyde Amendment, even among politicians who were nominally pro-choice, which was part of the reason why President Biden was at the time, I think, supportive of the Hyde Amendment. It wasn't at all unusual to be. Mm-hmm. But I think now, as the Democratic Party has become more progressive, and particularly on abortion rights, and particularly on what some of us would see as reproductive justice issues, issues that primarily affect low-income people, Biden has changed course and says he now opposes the Hyde Amendment. Now, whether he's actually, or I mean Democrats more broadly, are going to use political capital to eliminate the Hyde Amendment, given how many things there are on their agenda, is a different story, because we've seen before Democratic presidential administrations and Congresses that are committed in theory to ending the Hyde Amendment that don't make it a priority.
You know, what tops the Democratic agenda then when it comes to reproductive health, when it comes to contraception, and when it comes to abortion? What is at the top of the list?
Well, I think what probably is at the top of the list for the most part is still preserving Roe. I think there's been a kind of not necessarily healthy even obsession with keeping abortion legal. And I think there people have been kind of laser focused on the Supreme Court. The other question, I think, is if anything related to abortion is going to be a priority, because there are so many things that Democrats have kind of emerged from the Trump years, seen as deeply problematic, and some of them connected, of course, to the Capitol insurrection and people's belief that the election was stolen and so on. So there's no shortage of problems that Democrats want to tackle. And for the Hyde Amendment to go, it would likely be controversial, especially given that Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who is, arguably kind of the most powerful man in the Senate now, has signaled that he is not necessarily in favor of eliminating the Hyde Amendment.
If you're just joining us, we're discussing how the Biden administration might approach reproductive health, contraception, abortion. Mary Ziegler, a professor at Florida State University College of Law and a legal scholar in this area, taking your questions as well. What do you think about the legacy of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade? Where do you perceive our society's views on abortion now? How would you like to move forward from here? 800-642-1234. Mary, maybe the last time we talked was the Supreme Court had a major decision in June Medical Services versus Rousseau over the summer. Where does that blockbuster decision fit in the history of reproductive law in Roe? And that was the issue of, as you know, of course, the Louisiana law requiring abortion providers to get admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles.
Well, I think we're still waiting to see, because the precise meaning of June Medical is being contested in the courts as we speak. So as some listeners may remember, Chief Justice Roberts, in that opinion, seem to say that the rules that applied abortion restrictions were looser than they had been before. So in other words, it would be easier than it had been for states to pass abortion restrictions. Even though he didn't go all the way to overturning Roe, essentially he said states should get more deference than they have had when they want to restrict abortion. There's fights now about whether Roberts' opinion is actually controlling, right, whether that's the law or not. There are fights about what it means, but it seems to be the case in most lower courts that have the opportunity to think about this, that they're leaning towards saying that Roberts' opinion was in fact the law, and that June Medical represents kind of the first step on a path, or the first of several in this sort of death of a thousand cuts that we discussed.
Let's bring in John now in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hi. Sorry to take my mask off so you can hear me. I just wondered if your guest could comment on Planned Parenthood v. Casey. That's really the, as far as I understand it, that's more the precedent-setting case right now. And that imposed this undue burden standard has become such a mess, because how do you determine what is or is not an undue burden, and all these states requiring admitting procedures and stuff, closing down all the hospitals for abortions. And, you know, how do you clean that up?
The Casey decision from 1992, John is asking about.
Yeah, I mean, Casey is, of course, John is absolutely right, that it's kind of the case we're talking about. So when we say overruling Roe, we're talking about what remains of Roe after Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And as John says, Casey preserved the idea of a right to choose abortion, but then changed the rules that apply and essentially said that only unduly burdensome abortion restrictions would be unconstitutional. And the problem, as John notes, is that the court has never been that clear as to what counts as an undue burden. Now, both sides at various points have benefited from that. Pro-choice forces have been able to convince the court at times that the undue burden test means a little more for abortion rights. And anti-abortion forces have benefited too. I think there was a sense in which maybe the court could dial quite far back on abortion rights without officially overturning Roe and risking that kind of backlash. So that's still a possibility. I think there are conservatives on the court who would be at least a little intimidated by the prospect of political blowback, who might take advantage of the messiness that John describes and kind of use the undue burden test to give states more and more power to restrict abortion without really being clear about what's going on or confronting Roe directly. That said, I think there are more justices on the court now who want to say something direct about Roe and who will not be satisfied with that kind of covert route.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what we'll see playing out in the next month is a sort of fight between these conservative factions on the court, in particular to kind of determine what some of these conservative justices we don't know as much about, like Justices Coney Barrett,
Amy
Kavanaugh,
Coney Barrett,
Amy Coney Barrett, Brett Kavanaugh, and Neil Gorsuch are going to do on abortion. We simply don't have enough data points, even though we can make pretty educated guesses. They haven't really said much or anything about abortion as Supreme Court justices.
Is there an appetite to take these cases on?
That's the thing we don't know. I mean, we have every reason to believe that these are conservative justices, right? There's not going to be a lot of deep conviction about abortion rights on this court. But that said, we don't know if there's an appetite for taking abortion cases, much less overturning Roe quickly. So we'll be waiting to see. Potentially, you know, in the next half an hour, the court is going to be issuing orders from its most recent conference. It's considering, among other things, a case from Mississippi that would ban all abortions at 15 weeks. You know, if the court took a case like that, it would tell us a lot about how eager these justices are to reverse Roe.
Mary, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, as always. It's fun to come on.
Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law, where she researches abortion law and reproductive history. Just ahead, we talk with a prominent American historian about what we can learn from the Civil War and what mistakes were made when the Union reformed. Fast forward to today, does our divided nation and concerns about the security of the Capitol echo the Civil War's early years? Let's discuss. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.